Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kathy Curtis, an investment advisor and principal of Curtis Financial Planning. Today's program, Outliers and Outperformers, Women in Fund Management, is part of a month-long series entitled The Ascent of Women, which will explore the evolving status of women and their lives today. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. To put today's discussion into historical context, as of 2009, women constitute only 16% of executive and board positions in the financial services industry and less than 10% in mutual fund management. There are approximately 8,000 mutual funds in the U.S., to put that in perspective. On this panel, we have four women who have achieved breakthrough success in this male-dominated industry. In the next hour, we will get some insights as to how they do it and perhaps how more women can join their ranks. So, to introduce the panelists, Melody Hobson is president of Ariel Investments, a Chicago-based money management company, and she is also chairwoman of the board of trustees of the Ariel's mutual funds. She joined the company in 1991 after graduating from Princeton. Melody is a nationally recognized voice on financial literacy and regular contributor to ABC's Good Morning America, and also to many financial journals such as Black Enterprise, Money, and Forbes. She sits on several boards and is very active in the community. Ivka Kalas-Bistricki is the portfolio manager of the Pax World International Fund. Before joining Pax World, Ivka was a senior portfolio manager at State Street Global Advisors and Barings. She has a master's degree from the Fletcher School of Law and an MBA from INSEAD in France and attended Harvard as an undergrad. She also speaks five languages. Luz Padilla is head of Emerging Markets Fixed Income and senior portfolio manager for Double Line Capital, a Los Angeles-based bond management firm. Prior to Double Line, she was a managing director at TCW, where she headed the firm's emerging markets group and served as the lead portfolio manager. She earned an MBA from Berkeley and attended Stanford as an undergraduate. Mary Ellen Stanek is managing director and chief investment officer of Robert Baird & Company. Mary Ellen has 30 years of investment experience managing fixed income portfolios. Prior to Baird, Mary Ellen was president and CEO of First Star Investment Research and Management Company and director of fixed income. Mary Ellen attended Marquette University and earned her MBA from the University of Wisconsin. So I'd like to start with a few questions to get to know each of your personal stories a little bit. So if you could each let us know, why did you choose this industry? And what should you do to stand out or differentiate yourself from others? Ivka, would you like to start?
Sure. Actually, in my case, it was a lot of serendipity as opposed to a direct choice. I actually started out as a biology major as an undergrad and found out that I didn't actually like spending a lot of time in a lab, and so moved on to do a graduate degree at the Fletcher School. And when I graduated from there, the Iron Curtain fell down, and so I went to work in Prague, which is my native city, to work on privatization, and that got me into management consulting. And along the way, I had two children and realized that management consulting actually was not a sustainable career with the family, only because I was traveling 5 days a week and felt like everything was falling apart around me, and so I decided that I needed to make a big career shift, and out of the blue, someone who I had worked with in consulting called me up. He was working for Putnam Investments and said, you know, we're looking for a new metals and mining analyst, and I think you'd be perfect for the job. And so I went and interviewed, and that's how I started in the business. So it was complete serendipity in terms of getting in, and I found that the job worked really well in terms of how I think in terms of my ADD, so it's actually a good job if you can't concentrate on one thing at any point in time, but you can focus on a lot of things all at once. And all of the analytical background that I had for my biology degree, it all sort of just fit with the career, plus results are pretty much all that matter in this business. And so it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's really all about delivering the performance returns. And so that really worked well for me. And so I'm not sure what the skill set was, but I think that in terms of the analytical background, having a very broad perspective on how I look at problems, and also just having had some great mentors in the business that sort of saw some of my abilities and pushed me forward, are what took me from being an analyst at Putnam to being a portfolio manager at PAX.
I had the good fortune of meeting the person who started my firm, who also was a Princeton graduate. He graduated 11 years before I did. I met him when I was leaving to go to Princeton, and I quickly realized that he was this very unique person in the investment management industry, and that he started our firm when he was 24 years old, and his father had given him stocks every birthday and every Christmas instead of toys. And he said in the beginning it was not very fun, and he'd run to the tree, and the only thing he'd have was a white envelope. But the great thing was that his father let him keep the dividend checks, and his father was a child of the Depression. And he said that he was a 12-year-old with cash flow. And so if he wanted to buy a candy bar, he could buy a candy bar. But instead, he decided to reinvest the dividends and became obsessed with the stock market. So I heard this story when I met him. I was, you know, leaving to go to college. He had started the firm. And I realized he was someone special, and he was so unique because he was black. And there were no other people in the industry when he started Ariel who were of color in terms of African American. So we were the first minority-owned investment management firm to start in 1983. And so I met him, and I thought, this is an interesting business. And, you know, I never learned about the stock market, and I've never even heard it talked about at school. And maybe I'll learn about it at Princeton, and of course I didn't. And so I came to him one summer and said, could I be an intern? And I became an intern at the firm, fell in love with the business, and decided that's what I would do. The next summer, I went and worked at T. Rowe Price, and I came back, and I've had one job my entire life. So I've worked at Ariel for 19 years, and I'm 41 years old, so I joke, if you count when I was an intern, it's 21 years. So half my life, I've worked at the company, which has been fun and greatly rewarding. But when I think about what has allowed me, I don't know if I would say stand out, but maybe to distinguish myself in the industry, I think it's been two things for me. I think one has been my work ethic, which I don't think is very different than a lot of women, because we hustle. We work really, really, really hard. And I always just had an incredible capacity for work. And I could work for hours and hours. I'd sleep under my desk in the early years of working at Ariel. We had a joke at Ariel that my business partner told me I had to go to the gym. And I said, he said, I'm worried about your health. You have to go to the gym. And he said, if you don't go to the gym, I'm not giving you a bonus. So I said, you can't do that. And he said, bonuses are discretionary. So then, of course, I became obsessed with the gym. So my work ethic was something that I think really helped a lot, and I was willing to take all the assignments no one wanted. And then secondly, I think one of the things that truly made a difference for me were communication skills. We always ask people at Ariel, what is your genius? What is your towering strength? What is something you do better than anyone else? And in my firm, I'm one of the best communicators that we have, so that made a difference.
My story is I thought
Excuse me, this is Mary Ellen Stanek speaking, and that was Melody Hobson for our listening audience.
Thank you. It's Mary Ellen Stanek. My story is I thought I was going to go to law school, went to Marquette, majored in political science. My junior year, woke up one day and thought, I don't want to be a lawyer. What am I doing? Called home. My dad listened carefully, said, here's your mother. And my mom said, oh, honey, it'll be okay. God's got a plan. And I look back on it all, and serendipity, God's plan, but that's truly what happened. I took a number of business courses. My dad was a bank president. I worked in the bank my summers and Christmas breaks, and had good grades. And so at the time, then the largest trust company in Wisconsin was launching the money market funds. That's how old I am. I'm 54. This was in 1979, and there were no money market funds, so nobody had experience with money market funds, so they hired a fresh analyst. And so in the mornings, I would manage money market funds, and in the afternoons, I had huge blocks of time to research projects. And in my case, I researched the concept of duration, which is now very mainstream to bond portfolio management. It wasn't at the time. And we agreed that there was a lot of validity to the concept, launched some strategies, and launched some portfolios that became successful. A few years later, my boss was hired by Chase at the time to go create a business for Chase that we had helped pioneer. And at the time, I was 27, and they looked around, and I had more experience than anybody doing this, and was given a shot far sooner than otherwise would have been the case. So I became the chief investment officer of this team in 1983, and we stayed there. I spent the first 21 years of my career at first our First Wisconsin Firm Co., now part of U.S. Bank, and when I left was president of their mutual fund company and ran the asset management businesses. Started over, went to Baird 10 years ago, and started with $18 million, and today we run nearly $15 billion. In terms of, I look back on it, and what was the key ingredient? We call it the value proposition. It's a wonderful business in a lot of ways because it's objectively measured. And so it's pretty stunning that there aren't more women who have been able to break through, because if you, as I like to say, if you can put the numbers up, if you can put the portfolio numbers up and the business numbers up, it's hard to deny the value added, if you will. And I look back, and I was able to lead a very talented team that many of them are still with us today, where we were able to put the numbers up. So we were able to meet the objective standard. And in the end, it didn't matter if I was a woman, 27 years old, or had orange hair. I never had orange hair, but I used to joke about that it didn't matter because we had the numbers. And then the second piece of it, I would say, is the people piece of it. I think that's by far my greatest strength, that I can discover talent and see talent in people and build teams and connect with clients. And so it's called the EQ piece of it. That's the piece I think that is probably my greatest strength.
Thank you. Luz Padilla.
Hello. My family and myself, we lived in Mexico, and we moved to the States when I was 11. My dad was a banker, and so for me growing up, I always sort of imagined myself working in the realm of finance. I didn't know exactly what, but I knew that I was going to be in the business world. So I, when we moved out, we lived in Southern California. I went to school up at Stanford. I got my undergrad in econ and then decided to take a couple years off school because I wanted to go back to business school at some point. And then something incredibly fortunate happened to me. I decided to go to Berkeley for my MBA. And at that point in time, there was a new fellowship. It was in the second year of its launch. The Robert A. Twiggle Fellowship had just started. And I was asked to participate and become a fellow. I didn't know how lucky that opportunity that came to me was going to prove itself to be, because not only did it introduce me into the world of money management, they also gave me a mentor to help guide me through that, as well as paid for school, which, you know, after you graduate, it gives you incredible flexibility in terms of what you decide to do. And so the only thing that they asked of me was that I basically make an effort to go into money management. And I think I look back now and I talk to Sue Twigo, who is obviously one of the founders of the fellowship. And, you know, I think I was one of their sort of success stories, because not only did I immediately start in the money management industry, I ultimately became a portfolio manager. I started at TCW in the emerging market fixed income group and basically worked my way up. I started as a summer intern. I then became an analyst. I did trading. I became a credit analyst, both on the corporate and the sovereign side. And then I was given the opportunity to run the team and take over the mutual fund and become the head portfolio manager. I think I look back at my story, and I think certainly one of fortune. I didn't know what led me there, but I think I also was able to take advantage of that opportunity, again, because of the history, the strong work ethic that was imparted on me by my parents. And, you know, I look at what we do today, and yeah, it is all about just posting the numbers and making money for investors. But at the end of the day, it's a relationship business, and you have to be good with people, and you have to. So I think caring for people, and not just, you know, making money, but the way that you make it, making sure that you protect your investors at all time, as well as you're a fair and good person to work with, I think is important.
Okay, thank you. So, what do you all think has been your greatest career challenge so far that you were able to overcome? Melody, would you like to?
It's burned in my memory. It's definitely the financial crisis of 08. And that for me was a moment of truth. It was one of those times where everything that you think you're made of is called into question. And I always say that in life, you think you are something until you're actually confronted with the issue. And you just don't know. You don't know when it comes to your team, and you don't know when it comes to yourself. And so in that crisis, we learned a lot about our individual teammates, and I think we learned individually a great deal about ourselves. And I think it was one of the most significant challenges. There were lots of other challenges along the way, but that was very, very significant because in the face of near financial Armageddon, you had a choice. And the choice was to continue to do what you do, which in our situation was to be very contrary and to continue to buy stocks as they were falling off cliffs. Or you could sort of sit on your hands and wait for the dust to settle, which was a very safe and reasonable thing to do. And we decided to buy. And so we were buying stocks like Gannett, which were at one time earning at $1.67 a share. We were buying stocks like Royal Caribbean, where an analyst took the price of the stock in one day from a target price of $19 a share to $1. And these were crazy, crazy, crazy moments. And to watch it every single day was extraordinarily trying. It was also very hard because clients left. And I'd spent 19 years trying to get people to have faith and trust in us and to build up, you know, create wealth for them. And they just easily walked out the door. And I was devastated for a moment. And I actually have a really brilliant boyfriend who said to me, you know, Melody, you're from Chicago. And in Chicago, the one thing that you know about is snow. And I said, okay, I don't know where you're going with this. And he said, well, one of the things you know about when you're in a blizzard, you watch your feet. You never look up at the storm. Because if you look up the storm, you lose your footing and you fall. But if you watch your feet, you just get from one place to the next. You're in the middle of a really bad storm. Watch your feet. And so I went back to my office and I said to everyone, we're just watching our feet. Our goal is to get till tomorrow and then to get to next week and then to get to next month and then to get to next year. And if we get to next year, we're going to be fine. And it was one of those moments that I have to say that was extraordinarily challenging. Last but not least, I would say, there was a day I remember waking up and the futures markets were already down several hundred points. And I was staring at my mirror and I wake up really early in the morning. And I was thinking to myself, God, this is going to be a really hard day yet again. And I kind of was hyperventilating, and I'm not that person. And then the only thing that I could think of to get me through that moment was to say, Warren Buffett does not hyperventilate. So if Warren Buffett is sleeping soundly somewhere in this country, which I'm sure he is because it was 4 a.m, I said, I think I'm going to be fine. So those were the kind of things that I thought about at the time. It was a blizzard. Watch your feet. Warren Buffett does not hyperventilate.
Thank you. Luz, what was your greatest career challenge?
Well, you know, I work in emerging market debt, and basically since I started back in 1994, we had a crisis almost every year or every other year. So in 94, it was the peso devaluation. In 95, it was the Argentine and tequila crisis. In 96, 7, we followed that with the Asian crisis. In 98, it was the Russian crisis. In 99, Brazil devalued. And, you know, I could go on. And then followed by the 2008, which was a big one, global banking crisis, I guess, or U.S. banking crisis, however you want to term it. But I think... So I think for me, you know, in terms of work-related crises, I basically walked into all of them. And so in 2008, that was actually not that bad because I'd been there before. I think one of the greatest challenges for me has really been more on a personal level. At the end of last year, my boss was basically given his walking papers from TCW. He then left to start his own firm, Double Line, and he gave me the option to follow him. And for that option, I basically was going to walk away from a job into a new job with no promises of payment because we are a startup. And so there was no money. Nobody was going to be earning anything for some time. But he also gave us the promise of owning the company. And I had to think long and hard about it because it wasn't just myself, you know, that I was making that decision for, but my team, because he also asked that if I wanted to bring some of the team members, that if I wanted to bring some of the team members that, you know, I could do so. And so I had that very difficult conversation with some of my team members, a couple of whom I'd been working with since the mid-90s. And one in particular who is a father. He's the sole income earner and is a father of four. And when he decided to join me, I just felt incredibly, again, blessed and lucky because here's this man placing his trust in me, and I'm placing my trust in somebody else. And I think we all decided to take that leap of faith. And now it's been 7 months later, and I'd say we couldn't be happier about our decision. We are very, we are very hopeful about the business, and I think we've gotten off to a great start.
Mary Ellen,
My greatest challenge was in 2000, deciding to leave a company that I had spent 21 years at and had helped build a business and led a team and led a significant part of the company, and the business had been acquired. And things changed very radically. It was just different. It wasn't necessarily better or worse. It was different. And I had to start over. And I knew my decision was going to provoke others on the team, and I knew it would put clients and our shareholders into a bit of a challenge in terms of what their decision was ultimately going to be. As I told Luz when we met earlier, that I can understand the emotion of what she's going through, having gone through that, and I hope her story is like mine, that 10 years later, the challenges get minimized emotionally, and you remember the good things, and you see the success that's come about it. But as Melody said, those kinds of environments, whether they be market-related or a change in terms of where your address is going to be, it really defines you, and that's when you decide how tough you really can be and what's important to you. And the final thing, my husband's a dentist. He has a great line for me whenever I get wound up about something professionally. He'll say to me, "Did anybody die? I missed that part of the story." And I, you know, it's disarming because you always stop and laugh and go, "No, actually, nobody did die yet." And it just, he grounds me. And that really is very, very helpful to have that kind of perspective around you, that when you think the end all and the be all is something about this business, and then you get back to the basics, quite helpful.
Ivka?
I actually don't have one greatest challenge, or rather, I have the same challenge in this business that I feel like I never really overcome, and that is that from my perspective, there's a dichotomy in the business, and it may have to do with who I am, but when I do my job, I see the world as a really big shade of gray. So there's really no right answers, and when I look at what I can invest in and how I can make money for my clients, I sort of recognize the fact that I'm going to be wrong all the time, and the whole point of the exercise is to get the numbers on my side and to make decisions because I have to. I have to take risk. I have to make decisions. And then hopefully, if I'm doing my job well, then I'm going to make more right decisions than wrong decisions. So there's that side of it, big gray area. The market is different every day. And what I believed yesterday may be different from what I believe today. And yet, when I speak with my colleagues, when I talk to potential clients, they want certainty. They want to know which direction is the market going, and you're the one, you're the expert, you're supposed to know that, so please tell me, and what is the next hot stock? And so dealing with that dichotomy of at least understanding the uncertainty and sometimes being on the wrong side of it and feeling like I'm an idiot, and yet being able to convey a sense of confidence to the outside world is a huge challenge for me personally, and one that I face every day, and I can't really say that I've overcome it.
Lots of us feel that way every day. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Outliers and Outperformers, Women in Fund Management, with Melody Hobson of Ariel Investments, Ivka Kallis-Bistricki of Pax World Funds, Luz Padilla of Double Line, and Mary Ellen Stenick of R.W. Baird & Company. Now I'd like to go on to a few questions about the financial mutual fund industry in general. How would you describe the culture in the fund industry as you were working your way up or clawing your way up and today? Mary Ellen, would you like to start?
Sure. Fortunately, having been employed by only two investment advisory organizations, I only personally have experienced on the inside two entities. And I will say at the First Star Funds and now with the Baird Funds, fortunately, they are complexes and companies that were built with the shareholder in mind. And so as the funds have been built from an investment strategy vantage point, as the funds have been priced, they have, and all of the business practices have put the shareholders' interests first, which is aligned really with how we manage the businesses overall. And so it's barely been quite easy for me because our job, the hardest part, is living in that gray area where you need to make decisions all the time in terms of risk versus the alpha or the potential return you're taking on. And that's the only headwind. That's the challenge we've gotten. And it's admittedly a big one day in and day out. But not worrying about, gee, who's on the other side of this trade? Or am I competing? How do I allocate my time? For example, we do not and never have and never will manage money, competing interest money for the firms we work for. If they want to invest with us, come on into the funds with us, where we're all eating the same cooking. So I've never felt that we had that tug of war ethically going on with how we'd go about managing these portfolios versus the firm's capital. Unfortunately, I think the industry has put itself in a position where there is a lot of question mark about where loyalty and where interests lie. And that saddens me a great deal because at the beginning and the end of the day, the business that we are in, it's a trust business. It's a confidence business. And it's a business of great responsibility. And every day I think about my mom's in these funds as a shareholder, my neighbors, I'm in there, my family's in there, that every single day that's a huge responsibility. And I have got to put those interests first and foremost, as does the entire portfolio team.
Would anyone else like to answer that question?
I thought I'd just throw in the fact that since we are talking about women in asset management, might as well raise the topic of the elephant in the room, which is that less than 10% of asset managers or portfolio managers are women. And I do think that the culture is too homogenous because of that. I mean, in my history, and I have worked for a number of asset management firms, until I came to PAX, where actually half of the PMs are women, I've always been the only PM on the teams where I've worked. And I can count on one hand the number of people of color I've actually worked with. So it's an incredibly homogenous business. I don't want to say, you know, what that means, macho risk-taking. We can talk about that later. But what it does mean is that there's a lack of diversity that people bring to the table that I don't think is healthy for the business. And I'm very much hoping that we'll see an evolution in asset management, just like we've seen in most other fields that were once male-dominated, and at some point in time something changed, and now they're at least 30, maybe 50% women, and I think that they're really much better for that. And I'm I'm hoping to still be around when that actually happens in our business.
I was just going to add, and I totally agree with you, that when I started in the business, I was 22 years old, and I would describe the industry as being very white, very elite, very male, very exclusive. And I think that that comes with enormous long-term challenges. And I contrast that. Let me just back up. One way to make the point and put a fine point on it is there are 9,000 mutual funds, which was mentioned. And in the newspaper, if you open up USA Today as an example or the Wall Street Journal, there are about 500 mutual funds listed because of their size. We have about $3 billion in mutual fund assets. We are the only company in the newspaper that's black. It's 2010. So that gives you a sense of where the industry is. We're literally the only company. So the diversity issue is pretty dramatic. Now, at the same time, I contrast that with the fact that I work at a very diverse firm. I'm a woman president of the firm. I'm a woman chair of the Mutual Fund Board of Trustees. And so I've seen the two sides of this coin in a way that's pretty enlightening. It helps me to really have a good sense of what does make for success over the long term. So for all the lack of diversity that continues to exist in the industry, the amount of diversity inside of my company, I believe, gives us the long-term edge. And so it's actually, in some ways, a competitive advantage for us. When you think about all the potential customers out there, all the ways that people use products that you're trying to understand as an investor, all the potential investment opportunities that are out there, you want a whole group of different people around the table to make those decisions. And the way that someone explained it to me once is a very simple question that you ask yourself. When you're making big decisions that affect people's lives and their livelihood and their ability to send their kids to college or buy a home or start a business, is everyone in the room? And the great thing is when we look at who's in the room at Ariel, we can say, we got a lot of people in this room who come with a different point of view. And we actually embrace the idea that at Ariel that conflict leads to a better decision. So if we sort of say to ourselves, if we're in a room and we are vehemently disagreeing with each other, we're going to have a better outcome. Because as you all know very well, when you are with people who are so like-minded, you go down a path of groupthink. And groupthink and investing is a very bad thing. So I have to say, industry-wide, there is one culture that I pray we can be a sign of what needs to change by hopefully delivering excellent results to our clients over the long term that will demonstrate this model is a better model. But at the same time, in my own company, it reinforces. And one last point about it. Now, if you watch television, it's very interesting to me that let's take a show like Grey's Anatomy. Grey's Anatomy has all different types of people on the show. So as a result of that, they pull in audiences that are black, Hispanic, Asian, white, men, women, perhaps more women, but still. So there's a whole cadre of people that watches the show. Versus I remember watching Oprah once. I was in a hotel room somewhere going to a meeting, and she was interviewing the cast of Friends, and she said, there are no black friends in New York. And so it sort of lets you know the world is in a different place. And the question is, you know, are you willing to be a part of where the world is going or not? And to the extent you don't make that decision, you ultimately deal yourself a less, let's call it, rewarding hand.
Well, this brings up a statement that's been made in the financial press. Some say that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Brothers and Sisters, the financial meltdown may have been avoided or less severe. What do you women think of that?
I'm looking at one. This is Mary Ellen Stanek. I'm looking at one of my colleagues who spent 20 years at Lehman Brothers, and he's nodding as I'm smiling at him. I think that's very much the case. That and Melody did a really nice job talking about whether it's groupthink or, you know, I put it, even well-intended people don't necessarily stand up and say, today I'm going to be biased. Today I'm going to build an all-white team and have most of the power held by white men who all went to the same kinds of schools and grew up in the same kinds of neighborhoods. Nobody, or at least I don't think they set out to be like that and think like that, but they go with who their circle of friends are, who, where they were, who they knew, how they went about recruiting. They go back to their own schools. And you got to poke at that and say, wait a minute. And for us, it was our firm's number one source until a few years ago was of new employees was referrals from existing employees. Well, that was the aha moment for me, and I volunteered to head up the firm's diversity steering committee at the executive level for the firm. That was the aha moment. So if you're largely white dominant, male dominant historically, no wonder you're not moving the needle as much as you want to, despite being very much a great place to work. So you got to really start challenging those things. And in Lehman Brothers' case, whether it's the risk modeling, I think it would have been different. It would have just been a wider lens, a wider perspective.
Anyone else want to comment? Lehman Brothers versus Lehman Brothers and Sisters?
Sisters and brothers.
Okay. Well, let's talk about women's investment styles versus men's. Do you think women evaluate risk and reward trade-offs differently than men do in managing funds? Luz, want to make a comment?
Well, I'm not sure differently, but, you know, I think because we're all individuals, and so we all have our own style, if you will. Although I do think that we were joking about this earlier today, that there is something to be said for women getting the job done. And, you know, we were talking about how this meeting basically came together and how when we know that there's something to be done, we just sort of grind through it and get it done. Because completion at the end of the day is what's important. And obviously a good job is also it's the most important thing, but also getting it done. And I like to think of myself as not so much of a procrastinator, but I do admit that there are times when I leave things to the very last minute, but I never fail to, you know, end up getting the job well done.
Ivica, do you have an opinion on?
You know, from my own perspective, I can't really judge because, again, having worked with so few women until coming to my current firm, I did always feel that I personally was more risk aware of how I managed funds, you know, being aware of especially what I don't own, because I always feel like that's one of the biggest risks you take in a portfolio. It's not the 50 or 60 stocks that you own. It's the 10,000 stocks that you don't own out there. That's really the big risk and being very aware of that. And always getting a blank stare when I explain that to some of my colleagues. So feeling like there was something missing, but certainly not across the board. And I've worked with some fantastic risk managers who were men. But I did bring along, there was a study done a year ago. Someone actually looked at this. And it was put out by the National Council for Research on Women called Women in Fund Management. And they did look at women's management styles against men's. And I'll just read this here. They found that women tend to be more consistent investors, holding investments longer and processing a greater level of informational detail, including contradictory data in making decisions. And on the other hand, men tend to manage actively, meaning they trade more often and base their decisions on sort of big picture themes. So they concluded that the men sort of miss out on all that stuff, that stuff that they don't own, and women being more aware of that. So it was sort of consistent with my own experience.
Okay. From that same study, there is this thought that when women become somewhat more of a majority in a group, and the key number is 30%, people start looking at them as women and more as part of the team. How do you feel about that? Is there a 30% women in your management teams, in your companies? And do you think it makes a difference when there is a majority?
There is 30% in my team. A lot of our departments are headed by women, so Client services and marketing on the institutional side is a woman. Mutual funds is a woman. Our general counsel is a woman. Our head trader is a woman. Our chief compliance officers, we have two, are both women. So we have very, very senior women leadership at Ariel. I'm not sure if I believe the 30% rule. I think it's more a function of the individuals and their willingness to drive change and to deliver on their convictions. And so I've seen plenty of situations where there's one woman in the room and she's extraordinarily effective. And this idea of somehow they become seen as women, I don't know. My experience, and I say this without sounding or hoping to come across as being in any way that it's problematic, I think people see women pretty quickly when you walk in the room in this industry. And the way that I had someone say it to me once, which I think is so funny, I think they see race first, and I think they see gender second, and they come pretty fast. And I remember talking to someone about it once, and not in a way that I was complaining about it, but the way he said it to me was the former head of human resources at Pepsi, "How long have you been black?" And I was like, "My whole life." And so when you are sort of very aware and you recognize that people see things in a different way, I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference. The bottom line, I think, is you as the individual and you deciding what you want to stand for and what you want to be. And I have to say, for me personally, I've been in a number of situations, and even sometimes with my own team, so I don't want to make it seem like this isn't something you have to continually work on, but I've been in situations with my own team where especially some of the women, I have to push them very, very hard to speak their truth and to not be overwhelmed by another guy in the room who maybe has a louder voice or who's exercising a bit more bravado. And I actually try to show them in my own way, not being a jerk about it, but certainly being very, very clear about what my beliefs are and not being a shrieking violet, so they can see if you stand up for what you believe in, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? I say it to them all the time. What is the worst thing that can happen? Someone fires you and... You know, it's like you go on and do something else. What's the worst thing that happened? They don't like you. And, you know, so those kind of things I think we have to get over, because our natural tendency is to want to belong, at least my experiences. And sometimes that means me included. But I've always pushed myself to go beyond that sense of being included and instead really, really stand up for what my point of view is. And that doesn't mean I'm always right.
I would tend to come down, this is Mary Ellen Stanek, on the same side as Melody. I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to the 30% kind of rule. Two of the six named portfolio managers are women, so a third technically are women, and we have several senior female investment managers or analysts, and our COO is a woman. So very talented, very important roles for them. I would say it's this other issue, and that is going back to teams and not building teams that all look the same and think the same. And so the constant challenge is to keep it's a mosaic, keep adding to it, and giving that new talent and that different talent a voice. Morningstar came in to spend some time on site with us a couple of years ago to do a profile, and the thing they came back on, which I was really pleased, was one of our younger people, in this case a woman, they said, "We were so impressed by the voice they're given by those of you who have so much more experience." And I said, "But that's how you avoid this group think. If you've worked with people all of your, most of your career, and you think they're great and they're really talented, you also run the risk of potentially seeing the world the same way." And constantly, one of my friends calls it putting microphones out into the bleachers to hear those voices. And at the end of the day, you might agree to disagree, but it's going to make it a better decision because they had voice. And I think that's the key, whether people, talent of color, female, male, Martians, blue Martians, you know, making sure we're giving those viewpoints and that talent, and it is talent, a voice to be heard.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Outliers and Outperformers, Women in Fund Management, with Melody Hobson of Ariel Investments, Ivka Kalas-Bistecki of Pax World Funds, Luz Padilla of Double Line, and Mary Ellen Stanek of R.W. Baird & Company. Okay, so on this same question about women, staying on the same topic, one of your top goals must be to attract capital to your funds, right? And so how do gender stereotypes fit in attracting capital? Is that an issue at all?
This is Luz Padilla. It's interesting because I've been working for a mutual fund, group for a while, but I think it's only been recently that I've had a much higher profile, if you will, in the whole marketing aspect of those mutual funds. Most of the marketing had been really done to the institutional level, and so there's a difference in the way that you interact with clients. And I have to tell you that at the retail end, I've been really surprised by the response that I've gotten from other women. And it's been extremely supportive simply because they probably don't see that many portfolio managers or hear about them. And I just think that we're incredibly fortunate that there are so many women out there that are starved for, you know, these types of products. And one of the comments that I got back from this person was, you know, if you were a man, you would have 10 times the assets because, just people don't necessarily look at your fund because of that. And it's interesting to me that in this day and age that still matters. I think that the marketing to the retail customer has been an eye-opener for me because you get all kinds of different just people from different walks of life. But it's been a lot more rewarding because you actually get to touch people. One of the things that I really don't like about this business is that there isn't that much interaction with people. And I think at some level, this gives me that connection because at the end of the day, this is somebody's retirement money. This is somebody's college fund. And, it brings you back and makes you realize what this is all about.
Anyone else like to talk about money coming into funds? And go ahead.
This is Ivka Kalish-Bistritsky. I do think there is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in the business overall because there are so few women managing money, and there's a perception that women aren't as good at capital raising. And in our business, of course, our goal is to make money for our clients, but the way we get paid is based on the number of assets we bring in. And so that perception also leads to perhaps women getting promoted less into these very senior management roles where they are the primary spokespeople for their funds. And so but I don't know if those numbers are proven. Again, because there's so few women, how do we even know that they're any better or worse than attracting capital? So I feel like, when we were talking about the critical mass theory, that in a way, to have more women in the business, at least we could test some of these assumptions that exist for whatever historical reasons there are, and it may very well be erroneous, but bringing in assets is a big part of what we do here, and that's how we make our money. And then in terms of my own experience, I've found going into the world that I manage in now, which is sustainability investing, what we call ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investing, where part of the philosophy is looking for gender diversity in management in the companies that we invest in, seeing that as a positive in terms of investment returns. And so the natural audience, the natural clientele for my fund are already believers in that, and therefore having a woman manage the fund may actually be a positive gender stereotype for my type of investing. But what I'd really like to see, again, is in the business is seeing women managing money as being a positive across the board, not just for sustainability strategies.
What happens to a fund manager who doesn't attract capital? And how are you measured, and how much time are you given, things like that?
A fund manager that doesn't attract capital goes out of business. and we're measured on performance. And so I actually, if I tie these two questions together, I actually see no gender stereotyping and asset raising because I think people go where the returns are. And that's the great thing about the business that we're in, that there's a score every single day. Every night I know how we've done versus our peers and versus the benchmarks. And it's no different than being a basketball player where you see your wins and losses. It's no different than very, very specific score-related businesses. And so as a result of that, the good news about it is it's a great equalizer. Now, the one thing about that that I would say, one caveat, I remember once saying to a very, very, very senior person at Citibank, I was talking about Ariel and talking about how we were interested in doing some business. And I said, all things being equal, you know, X, Y, and Z. And this individual said to me, Melody, one thing that I'm going to teach you today that is going to be very significant for you for the rest of your life is that all things are never equal. And so I think that when some of the question and what you're getting at is the manager has to have the performance as a baseline for success. I mean, that's just, you know, like 101. But beyond that, there are all sorts of other things that make an enormous difference. So the ability to communicate an investment strategy in a way that people will find interesting and understandable is also extraordinarily important. Having good people that stand for the brand standing for something, which in our business is very challenging. At Ariel, we have a turtle as a logo, and we call ourselves the patient investors. And we say slow and steady wins the race because we borrow it from Aesop's fable, which was written in 550 BC and still stands the test of time. But there are lots of investment companies out there that have a brand that doesn't stand for anything, which is not how we think about Coke or Pepsi. It's not how we think about Clorox bleach. It's not how we think about so many other things where you know what that brand stands for. With a name like Smucker, it has to be good. I could go on and on and on. So in the investment business, yes, it's the results. Yes, it is the ability to communicate those results. And then ultimately, I believe it's the brand and what that brand stands for that brings people in. And the firms that have been most successful have done an extraordinary job establishing their brands. Fidelity, Faithful, Vanguard, Cheap. I mean, I could go on and on about what these brands stand for. Well, wide swaths of people understand it. And hopefully one day, the Ariel Turtle too, or today.
So in other words, marketing is really key into what kind of money comes into your company and into your funds. So you need a whole team to help you. It's not just the individual. I mean, how can you do all of that, manage your portfolios and market? Or do you? Do you all help market, too?
This is Mary Ellen Stanek. Some days better than others to the question of how do you do it all. In my position, it is needing to do some of it all, in particular the visibility and the marketing. And it is about being able to stand for the brand. I will say institutional investors are starting more and more to ask the question of what is the firm's diversity policy and what, you know, tell me more about these things. And it's not just those who have a socially responsible mandate or public funds. We're seeing it more and more. And so at times it is an advantage to go in as an institutional money manager, whether it be for the fund application or separate account, as with the chief investment officer as a woman and has been for a long time. So all of that, it is some of all of it, but at the end of the day, you have to be surrounded by strong teams and talented teams, both at the office and on the products, but certainly in your personal life.
I'm a big believer in focus. It's actually one of the tenets to our investment strategy. It's a tenet to how we run the firm. And so what I would say to you is I think there are very few people who are jacks of all trades. And that saying is a saying for a reason and a master of one. You want masters at things. And if it's masters in terms of marketing, if it's masters in terms of investing, there are very few people who are both. Warren Buffett is a brilliant investor, the greatest of all time, and the most effective communicator in the entire industry. He's in a class of one when it comes to that. And even he still has other people who obviously round out his team. But I think overall, you have great investors. And I actually, at Ariel, I am not the portfolio manager. My business partner, who got the stocks when he was 12, is the one with the rest of the team managing the portfolios, although I have a hand in lots and lots of things that go on there. And then my job is to make sure the railroad runs on time, that the rest of the firm works every single day. And by dividing those responsibilities very, very clearly, having bright lines in terms of who's on first, I think we're able to be more effective and ultimately to get more done and ultimately to develop, as I discussed earlier, our geniuses.
I'm going to ask a couple questions from the audience now. There are several about work-life balance issues. I don't know how many of you have children, but I'm sure some of you do. And I can imagine the investing world is extremely demanding, especially today. So would anyone care to comment on that and how you deal with that kind of thing?
This is Mary Ellen. I'll start. My husband and I have been married for 32 years. We have three children, 24, 21, and 17, and I became a better money manager and a better manager of people on December 31st, 1985. You asked the significance. That was the day Peter Stanek was born. And while there's lots of balls to balance and you need great people and great teams around you, having that focus and that perspective and that grounding has really help my perspective. And so the advice I give is surround yourself with great people. Be very laser-like in terms of what you want and what's really important to you. If you looked at my calendar right now, whenever our kids' initials show up on my calendar, those are non-negotiable spots on my calendar. And it might be something, you know, a soccer match or a room mother thing that I did along the way. And that's how I did it. I run one integrated calendar, and all of it's on it, and it gets a little crazy at times. But at the end of the day, thanks to a husband who's a dentist who doesn't travel and could be grounded on the home front and great support at home and at the office, I've been able to do it, and I believe can lead and be a role model for other women.
So I have no children. I have a 17-year-old stepson with my boyfriend, but it's his child. I've just taken him on as mine since I've been with him since he was a child. And what I would say is that I think in life there are choices. I don't aspire to this idea of work-life balance because it implies that when you're working, you're not living. When you're living, you're not working, you know. And so for me, I just don't make those distinctions and those lines in the sand. There's a line in the book Good to Great by Jim Collins that I think it's the first line of the book. It says, good is the enemy of great. And we talk a lot about this concept in my firm. And the reason I say that is because there is a huge, huge difference between good and great. And you just have to decide what you want to be. And in making that decision, you make a lot of choices. And the huge difference between good and great is good, you can be fantastic. You can have a great life. Great means you're obsessive. And when I think about people who are truly great, who have done things that have moved the needle in society or in an industry, I think that they have been consumed with the work. I don't think Martin Luther King was talking about work-life balance. I just don't. I think he had a calling and a passion that consumed his life, and we are a better society for that. Now, do I believe that we can be a better society for obsessiveness around money management? In my own way, I do, because I think of the work that I do as being more than just us making money for our clients, which is paramount and extraordinarily important in giving them a good life. Chuck Schwab here says that around Schwab, they feel like they're curing cancer because they make people's lives better. And I aspire to or subscribe to that same point of view. But at the same time, for us at Ariel, we say not only are we doing this, which all, of course, hopefully leads us to have good lives, of course leads us, the people that we work with, to have good lives, hopefully, if we do our job well. And of course, the bottom line should be makes our clients richer. But we also aspire to make this country financially literate. And we have this goal, which is to make the stock market a subject of dinner table conversation, first in the Black community where the conversation has not existed, and more importantly, in schools in this country. Because you can go to high school in America today and take an elective in woodshop or auto, which always leads me to ask audiences a very simple question. Who whittles in their spare time? Anyone cleaning their own carburetor? But you can't take a class in investing. And to me, that is a travesty. So from our perspective, this passion that we have around investing is not just about enriching ourselves and others, which I have to tell you, we're competitive and want to do all of that. But it's about what imprint could we make on society. And because we think that imprint could ultimately mean maybe we won't have financial crises, you know, 50 years from now. Maybe black kids will grow up understanding the Dow and the NASDAQ and the S&P and having participating in 401k plans to the same degree as our white counterparts, which we don't do today. Having the same kind of wealth that's created, retire comfortably, all of those things we say to ourselves, we're going to put everything we have into moving this needle because we can then do something that's bigger than ourselves and ultimately leave the world a better place. So does that mean I give up some things in exchange for that? Yes, but I'm willing to make that trade-off.
The communicator, for sure. Thank you, Melanie. Unfortunately, we have reached the time in the program where there is time for only one last question. So I would like each of you, in one sentence, to give some advice to a woman who wants to reach your level of success in either the investment industry or corporate America in general.
Well, from my experience, I think it's find a great mentor, someone who does what you do and has been successful at it, and have them help you achieve your goals by making those goals clear to him or her.
This was given to me by a woman who was the only president of a Motorola country, which was Canada, when I was about 24 years old, and she said two words: smile a lot. And I actually believe that. I think people want to work with people they like, that they have fun with, and they think make their days brighter and better. And so if you could start with that point of view, of course be, you know your stuff, but to go at it with a happy spirit, I think it makes a huge difference. And I know that was more than a sentence.
Find what you're passionate about and then go for it.
You took my line. You know, it's interesting because, and I'll just tell a little story. Before I moved to Double Line, I went and spoke to one of our local colleges, and I told them, you know, I love what I do, and I think it's because I'm passionate about what I do, and I would do it for free. Little did I know that 3 months later, that's exactly what I was going to be doing. But I do. I think that's exactly right. Find what you're passionate about and then just go for it.
Okay. Thank you so much to our panelists for their comments here today.
That's so funny.
We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.